This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the program, how artificial intelligence is giving us amazing technical capabilities, but also new hacking vulnerabilities. We'll look at cybersecurity in a connected world. But first, same-sex marriage was legalized by a federal law in July of 2015. Before that, certain individual states passed their own legislation laws. Hundreds of thousands of couples have been married since that time. Another demographic was also affected, though: gay, lesbian, and bisexual youth. That's according to a new study out this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And Ellie Newitz is here to tell us about those findings and other selected short subjects in science. She's the tech culture editor for Ars Technica. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So tell us, what did these researchers look at in this study?
So the researchers were actually initially interested in a public health question around why so many teenagers are vulnerable to suicide. And suicide is actually the second leading cause of death among people age 15 to 24. And it's a public health problem. And one of the things that has been found repeatedly in a number of studies is that sexual minority teenagers, gay, lesbian, transgender, non-binary teenagers are more vulnerable than the general population, and they tend to express suicidal thoughts or attempt suicide at a rate that's four times higher than the general population. And so what these researchers wanted to do was see if laws around gay, lesbian rights affected the suicide rates, or whether there was any kind of connection between the two. And so what they did was that they had this fantastic data set that had been gathered by the Centers for Disease Control that do an annual survey to see whether teenagers are at risk of a number of different things. But one question that they ask is whether the teenager has contemplated or attempted suicide in the past year. So they could break this data out state by state and see how the data were changing as the laws were changing at a state level. And so they looked at it from between 1999 and 2015, when the federal law changed. And what they found was really extraordinary, which is that as states changed their laws around gay marriage and made gay marriage legal, attempted suicide rates dropped in general teenage population by 7%. And among sexual minority teenagers, it dropped by 14%. And so it was really, again, we can't say that there's a perfect cause between the two things. You know, what you can't pass a law and then suddenly public health improves, you know, miraculously. But it's an incredible correlation. And it shows that changing the laws really can make things better in a public health sense and can really improve health outcomes for young people.
That's interesting. There are laws now being passed about transgender students in bathrooms. So maybe the same effect might be happening there.
I think that that's a really excellent point. I think this study provides a really good example of how having laws that make it acceptable, publicly acceptable, to be a sexual minority and to have sexual diversity can, as I said, can really improve health outcomes for a group that's super, super vulnerable to suicidal thoughts and suicide attempts. And so, you know, anyone who has kids or works with kids or cares about the next generation, this is a really important study to think about.
And it's certainly worth studying further, right, to see what happens as the laws change. Your next story is about detecting changes in the Earth's magnetic field through clay pots. I know you like archaeology, so this must be close to your heart.
It is, yeah. And this is a story about what happens when two scientific fields get together and learn something new. And this is a field called archaeomagnetism. And it's basically the sweet spot between archaeology and the study of Earth's magnetic field. And so what happened was this group of archaeologists had a fantastic record of the history of clay pots dating from about the 8th century B.C., up through the 2nd century B.C. And this was in Judah, the kingdom of Judah, which was a very bustling urban area, lots of cities and commerce. And it's in the area that now is sort of outside of Jerusalem today. And the people there had excellent record keeping. They had a great calendar. And the people who were making clay pots, whenever they forged a new pot, they would put a stamp on the handle. And the stamp was a representation of the current royal family that was in power. And because of the fact that there were such good records kept of who was in power and when, archaeologists have like a treasure trove of what are basically timestamps. They can look at these pots and say, yeah, we know from within, you know, 10, 20 years when this was made. So they know that the date in historical time. But there's another weird thing that happens when you fire a clay pot, which is that you bring it up to such a high temperature that it reaches what's called the Curie point, which is named after Pierre Curie, our friend. And he found that when you heat up certain metals to a certain temperature, it's different temperatures for different metals, they lose their magnetism. And as they cool down again, they reorient to whatever magnetic field is in the area, which is, in this case, with these clay pots, it's Earth's magnetic field. So there's little tiny pieces of metal in the clay that are reoriented to the exact, basically the exact shape of the magnetic field at that time. And you can look at the orientation of the particles and see what the polarity is of the magnetic field. You can see how intense the magnetic field was. And so it gives you a kind of record of what the magnetic field is doing.
Yeah, because we know it shifts. It shifts over time. The poles wander, and there was even times when the poles have reversed themselves. So
that's right. And so we know it is super interesting. And so now we know not just sort of deep time stuff about, you know, how the poles swap positions, you know, millions of years ago, but also they found that in the 8th century, there was a huge spike in the intensity of the magnetic field just in a local area around where these pots were made. And then the magnetic field lowered in intensity. So there was a big fluctuation, very dramatic. And it's the kind of thing which you wouldn't notice if you lived in an ancient society that was in the Iron Age. But today, if something like that happened, especially when the magnetic field lowered, it would probably cause satellites to malfunction. It might overload the electrical grid, because when the magnetic field is at a lower intensity, more highly charged particles from space and from the sun can zoom into the atmosphere and affect our electronics.
Wow, fascinating. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, Annalie.
Thanks a lot.
Annalie Newitz, tech culture editor at Ars Technica, talking to us from San Francisco. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And last week, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Medicine, two of the most respected research bodies in the world, released a report on the possibility of using genetic editing techniques such as CRISPR on human embryos, not just in the laboratory, not just then, but suggesting there could be cases that would warrant using the technique, such as to allow parents to protect an embryo from specific medical conditions. And up until now, the idea of genetically modifying humans has been totally off the table in the U.S., though there have been reports of scientists gene editing embryos in China. Joining me to talk about the good and bad of the report is Jocelyn Kaiser. She's staff writer at Science Magazine. Welcome.
Hi, Ira.
So tell us exactly what this report says.
Okay, so what the report says is there are many reasons why we need to be very careful about what's known as editing the human germline, that is, making changes to eggs or sperm or to embryos that could be passed on to the next generation. There's many reasons why we should be careful about doing this, but and be cautious about doing it, but there are a few rare instances where we may want to do it, and that is families that have a severe genetic disease that they are going to pass on to their child, that they can't prevent it any other way, that we might want to allow this to happen in those cases.
So that's the good news. So what's the bad thing here?
Yeah, so the bad thing is that some people are worried that, yeah, maybe it makes sense to do it in these very rare circumstances, but if we do let it happen, then it could sort of open the door to many other changes to embryos that we would not maybe feel so comfortable with, like modifying an embryo to make it a better athlete or make it smarter or have blue eyes or whatever. Many people are worried that that could happen once you open the door to editing a human embryo to prevent some serious disease.
So they might open the door to editing maybe blue eyes or dark hair or something like that that's really sort of cosmetic?
Right. Well, not just cosmetic things. I mean things like there isn't really a gene for intelligence, but if you could engineer that into an embryo, then, you know, would we create some sort of super race of humans? And what about the people who didn't have the ability to do this? Would they be left out?
Yeah. These type of edits on a developing embryo, could they potentially be passed down from generation to generation?
Yes, well, that's the concern, Ira, that if you do something, if you change the DNA of an embryo versus an adult or a child, that change will be passed on to that embryo's descendants. And that's something, you know, you couldn't stop.
Yeah.
Once you've done it, it's going to be passed on. And so that's one reason why people are worried about doing this. Do you want to start tinkering with our genes in that way?
Yeah, you know, the National Academies carry a lot of weight in what they say. But is this binding on anyone, the what they're talking about, and the way to be careful about it?
Yeah, it's not binding. It's really just advice, not only to the United States, but to other countries. And they can decide if they want to follow the advice. But as you said at the beginning, these are very respected bodies. And when they offer their advice on something, it will have a lot of influence.
Jocelyn, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome.
Jocelyn Kaiser, a staff writer at Science Magazine. We're going to take a break. When we come back, how much do you worry that someone might hijack your Amazon Alexa? Or how about an autonomous military drone? What about the brakes in your self-driving car? Oh, now we're talking about stuff that could be dangerous. Well, we're going to ponder the security of artificial intelligence and how to make it hack-proof, if possible. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Self-driving cars, they're almost here already. Digital assistants like Amazon's Alexa are growing in popularity. The military is testing drones that could operate independently of human operators. How much of our lives might soon depend on artificial intelligence? At Arizona State University this weekend, some of the top minds in computer science and artificial intelligence are gathering for the annual Origins Project Great Debate. They'll explore the challenges AI could present in financial markets, healthcare, national security, and even our democracy. For the Science Friday take, we borrowed a few of them to focus on one question that often has me wondering. How secure will our self-driving cars, our digital assistants, and even military systems be from the hackers, hijackers, and others who mean harm? For example, could someone exploit computer vision to make my self-driving car see, instead of a stop sign, a yield sign? Or how do we make sure that military AI doesn't make combat decisions with the wrong information? And how would we know if something was amiss anyway? That's what we'll be talking about this hour. If you'd like to join in, our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guest. Kathleen Fisher is Department Chair and Professor of Computer Science at Tufts University. She's also a founding program manager for High Assurance Cyber Military Systems at DARPA. Welcome to Science Friday.
Welcome.
You're welcome. Eric Horvitz is a technical fellow and director at Microsoft Research Lab in Seattle and one of the organizers of the Origins Project. A great debate this weekend. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be here.
Subbarao Kambapati is a computer scientist and engineering professor at Arizona State University in Phoenix and president of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. And they're all joining us from the studios of KJZZ in Phoenix. We want to hear from you. What do you think? Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Kathleen, before we even get too deeply into our conversation about artificial intelligence, let's talk a bit about how hackable our connected devices, our cars, and so on are today. For example, hackers hijacked our DVRs and cameras to crash many popular websites last October, didn't they?
Indeed. Yeah, our cars and other Internet of Things kinds of devices are actually pretty hackable at the moment. So researchers have shown a variety of ways of, for example, being able to hack into sort of typical modern automobile and rewrite all the software on the platform to make it so that the car does what the hackers want it to do instead of what the original manufacturer wanted to do. There are about five different ways hackers can reach a car from outside through the Bluetooth interface that lets you talk to the car without your hands, for example, or through the telematics unit that arranges to call for an ambulance if you're in an accident. Those are two different ways in which a hacker can break in. And once a hacker's broken in, they can change the software that controls how the cars brake or accelerate or steer or do lots of other functionality. Basically, cars are computers on wheels, networked computers on wheels, and are quite vulnerable to remote attack.
That's amazing. Eric, part of the excitement of AI is it brings us new capabilities. For example, when we're speaking about cars, it allows machines to drive a car, talk to us, or they do talk to us too, but it's also opening up new vulnerabilities of the sort Kathleen mentioned, does it not? I mean, there are things we...
Absolutely.
Unintended consequences, as we like to say.
Right. So AI promises fabulous value to humanity, you know, with contributions in healthcare and education and driving our cars and helping us to make progress in scientific fields. But when we build systems that are smarter, that can do more for us using machine vision, machine learning to understand situations, automatic decision making, like steering on a road, we introduce what I refer to as new attack surfaces, new places that AI and other systems and even human hackers could actually attack and inject new kinds of code, new kinds of imagery. You know, there's a fabulous piece of work that just came out on using AI itself as the attacker of these components. And this one example that's fabulous came out of Berkeley, where a stop sign was analyzed and transformed into another stop sign. Human beings look at these two signs and they see exactly the same thing.
Right.
But the smart AI system understood the pipeline, the machine vision pipeline used by the car, and could say with a surety that this was being viewed by the car as a big, bright yield sign.
And so they've purposely made octagonal, right? So we know that's the shape of a stop sign, and a yield sign is a triangle. But the hacking made that confuse the computer on the car.
Right. There are new kinds of attacks. They're even called, is a new kind of name, machine learning attacks. How do you actually control the actual stream of data coming into a system and understand in a devious, smart way how to make the system do things that the designers did not want the system to do, like the car to do the wrong thing? The other challenge for cybersecurity is the human element. You know, people are sometimes the weakest link in the security of systems, and in some... spine-tingling work going on. There's been work to show how you could do social engineering, sort of make people, and this is AI systems now being applied to get people to click on links by looking at large bodies of data, for example, lots of tweets, and understanding how to give an AI system the ability to write tweets that senior people at companies would feel compelled to click on.
Stop me. I can't help myself. Raoul, let's talk a bit about my personal digital assistant, for example, the stuff I carry around in my pocket, you know, my cell phone, whatever. Not on the internet, but in person, could they be hacked also?
Well, I think, first of all, the reason your cell phone is useful right now is it's all connected. And so, in fact, some of the same attack surfaces are actually present there too. One of the interesting questions, I think, related to the point Eric was making is, just like you can do image spoofing, you can do voice spoofing. So you can come to my home and you would be talking to me and I wouldn't see anything wrong, and yet you would be sending this sort of infrasonic sounds to my Alexa, you know, commanding it to do all sorts of interesting things. All of this, as worrisome as this sounds, it's sort of, you know, I'm reminded of this beautiful lyrics by, you know, Annie DiFranco, that every tool is a weapon, and the more beautiful, the more effective the tool is, the more interesting a weapon it can become, essentially. So the AI technology allows your, you know, programs to have the abilities to perceive, plan, and learn. And so you can now use that against them. And so that does open up interesting ways in which they can be compromised. But as I think Eric was pointing out earlier too, you know, AI can also, if it's part of the problem, it's also a huge part of the solution. In fact, many of the techniques for even, you know, normal cybersecurity, many of the techniques that are being used to essentially fight off attackers come from game theoretic techniques in AI, you know, including some of the work that we are doing on moving target defense systems, which basically can be, you know, the AI techniques can do much better job than the simple kind of techniques that people can use. So it's very much a part of the solution there.
So did I hear you saying that the AI systems can mimic my voice? I mean, we use those for identifying ourselves even, you know. So somebody can figure out a way to my voice.
So not that anybody wants my voice, but... So one of the very interesting questions, I think, that we are trying to understand in these AI systems is when a system sees as well as hears, is it exactly doing it the same way as humans do? You know, one of the examples that I think Eric was earlier mentioning about the stop signs, in fact, after changing the stop sign, people still see it as a stop sign. People still might see it as a school bus, and yet the system might see it as an ostrich. So we are in these beginnings of the understanding of machine vision and machine perception, where when they work almost like us, but when they fail, their failure modes are quite different from the way our failure modes are. And that can lead to interesting ways of course, failure, of course, as well as, you know, being hijacked. You know, you can hijack them. So,
I was going to say, Ira, I think we can all assume that within a few years, AI systems and advanced graphics and rendering will be able to really spoof in high fidelity ways your identity. Even videos of you talking and saying things, videos of leaders. I'll be showing some examples tomorrow night in the public session of some very compelling technologies that show how this can be done. And the reason we're getting together is to really sort of flesh out some of these adverse AI outcomes, because that's the way you can solve them. And as Rao pointed out a second ago, AI is also part of the solution. We think that not just AI, but mechanism design of various kinds, new kinds of proactive work to address all these challenges. That's why we're here. We're here because we think not just to call out problems, but to come up with solutions in advance of them becoming big problems for everybody.
Kathleen, what are the most vulnerable things now, do you think? I mean, because the cars are really not here yet. Stuff is here.
Well, the self-driving cars aren't here yet, but the cars that are connected to the outside world via networks are already here, and those cars already are under control. I mean, they already control all the features of the car that a hacker might need to take over the car. So it's already possible for a hacker to remotely break into a car that's on the highway and take over, make the car acceleration not work, make the car braking. In fact, it happened last summer. There was a Wired magazine reporter who was in a Jeep Cherokee barreling down the highway when two white hat hackers broke in to take over. They disabled the transmission, so the car basically stopped on the highway. Luckily, nobody was hurt, but that technology already exists. There's lots of Internet of Things kinds of devices that are essentially built without any security concerns in mind, right? People are excited about the functionality and the services that these new devices are providing and kind of rush to get the products out there. And we don't have a very good way of ensuring that these devices are built to good security standards. It's very hard to measure security, and it's very hard to monetize security, right? The models for who pays for security and would consumers pay the premium for devices that are more secure is really unclear. So the result is that there's actually a vast number of Internet of Things kind of devices that are connected and insecure. And we see sort of on a regular basis reports from the hacking community of, you know, this kind of device, you know, your refrigerator was hacked, your television was hacked, your pacemaker was hacked, your insulin pump was hacked, your car was hacked, you know, and on and on and on, right? Wow. So there's basically widespread vulnerability.
Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255 to Washington, D.C. Hi, Judy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello?
Hey there. Yeah, you're on.
Wow. Okay. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The person who was just speaking actually mentioned pacemakers. I was going to ask about that. I was talking with a young man who goes into the OR and calibrates pacemakers, and I asked him whether they're hackable. And he said, as far as he knows, his company's pacemakers are not hackable, but he does not know across the board whether that's possible. And since it seems that technology in general kind of gets put forward without examining the downsides. I just wanted to ask your guests what they thought about that kind of thing.
Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, guests, what do you think? Well, pacemakers, hackable,
well,
not
hackable? Yeah, absolute demonstrations of this already. I'll refer people to Kevin Fu's work, for example. He's looked very carefully at Michigan at medical cybersecurity. We find all sorts of interesting problems and challenges. Even pumps, intravenous pumps, that have been infected with malware that no one even knows is there, and the pumps are running very slowly. What's going on?
Right, Jerome Radcliffe showed that he could wirelessly hack his insulin pump to cause it to deliver incorrect dosages of medication. That was reported at Black Hat maybe 5 years ago. And I think when Cheney had his pacemaker implanted, they had the Wi-Fi functionality turned off.
Well, that
the Wi-Fi capability is there for a really good reason.
Well, that was the plot on House of Cards, wasn't it? Somebody's
Indeed.
The vice president was killed, his pacemaker was hacked.
Yeah, Elementary's had a number of plot lines that revolved around kind of cybersecurity problems.
Yeah.
I mean, the functionality exists for a really good reason. It's very useful that doctors can monitor what's going on with a pacemaker. So on the whole, it's a tremendous advantage that the pacemaker is Wi-Fi enabled. But there is this downside, and we need to pay, you know, my opinion is we need to pay more serious attention to making sure that the security vulnerabilities are addressed up front rather than after terrible things have happened.
Mm. Yeah,
Let me talk about, we're coming up to a break, but I want to get one point in about one of the scariest aspects of artificial intelligence, and that's using the systems in warfare. If by their nature these systems work in a way that is beyond human comprehension and, you know, out of control of humans, how will we know if the information they're acting on in wartime is accurate? It's really a cause for launching missiles, or just a mistake?
This is one of my top concerns right now with automation. Has always found that its first home in military systems, given the competitive nature of that endeavor. AI, of course, leads to new capabilities, and of course, it'll be used in a variety of ways: automation of surveillance, automation of decision making. There's a DOD, U.S. DOD directive out of 2012 that said we need to have meaningful human control in the loop with military, with weaponry. It's unclear, as the uses of AI grow in weapon systems and as the time criticality grows, where the first to strike wins, if we really can ensure we'll have human, particularly meaningful human control, especially with opaque systems that have to act very quickly. The other challenge with military, and I think is quite destabilizing, is we don't have very good models, typically when we field systems, of how interacting AI will work. Mm. Interacting agents on two sides of an adversarial conflict, we have the complexity of that typically is beyond the kin of the designs.
You mean it's like a chess game between the AI systems? Like,
exactly.
Who's
at very
overarch?
Fast time scales and with negative consequences.
Also, I think the humans being in the loop on all these very fast turnaround systems brings up its own question of realisticness. So eventually, I think we almost need AI systems monitoring other AI systems, and that just has to be the way we'll have to go, because you could have somebody in the loop, and, you know, even for something like Eye in the Sky, the movie, it was becoming very hard to figure out whether people actually are in the loop and whether in the control, and you know, fast iterations will make it even more questionable. I think so, really, it's going to be an arms race. You know, as Kathleen pointed out, you know, we are using these tools because they're very useful, but everything that's useful can also be hijacked, and you don't give up on that. You basically make security and safety a maintenance goal, and you have to use the same technologies to work towards ensuring.
We have to take a break. This we'll come back with this really interesting discussion with Kathleen Fisher, Eric Horvitz, and Raul Kambapati. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Lots of tweets coming in. You might want to follow us as we do the show, because interesting stuff. We'll be right back talking more about cybersecurity and artificial intelligence after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the next generation of cybersecurity threats in a world increasingly using artificial intelligence. My guests are Kathleen Fisher, Department Chair and Professor of Computer Science at Tufts, Eric Horvitz, Technical Fellow Director at Microsoft Research Lab in Seattle. Raul Campapati is a computer science and engineering professor at Arizona State University. Before we begin, a little bit of housekeeping here. Some tweets were coming in. Correct me, Alex Wilding says that the pacemaker episode was on Homeland, not on House of Cards. Of course. Of course it was. How did I get that wrong? We have other tweets asking, I'll just read them off. We'll go through them later a little bit. How do you think the recent death of SHA-1 plays into this? That was a computer code. That was cracked by hackers. Tweet from Jen says, would taking the human element out of driving outweigh the consequences of potential hacking with overall safety roads? Maybe we need to keep the people up. Let me follow up on a very interesting point that was brought up right before the break, and that is about can AI protect itself? Do we need AI to watch over AI? Do you agree with Raul, Kathleen, about that?
I think it offers promising possibilities. I think
that's
the challenges
so diplomatic
of the timescales.
Of you.
Sorry, I'm an academic by training. We're trained to hedge. No, I think that it probably something like that will be essential in that the timescales are such that humans won't be fast enough to be able to meaningfully intervene in many cases. And in other cases, the timescales will be so long that the humans won't be able to intervene in meaningful cases. Like there are examples of people in self-driving cars who like just stop paying attention because the car is doing such a great job. Right? People are really bad at staying close, paying close attention for a long period of time when it seems superfluous or not useful. So I think either timescale, too short or too fast, means that people won't really meaningfully be able to monitor. And the alternative is an artificial intelligence system. You know, the problem is that then you're limited by the scope of the artificial intelligence system, how you built it, how you trained it, what you anticipated and what you built into it, or what it was able to infer. The sort of unknown unknowns are an ongoing challenge.
Yeah.
Let's make a quick comment is that there is really fabulously interesting research going on giving AI systems the ability to understand unknown unknowns and to know their own limitations. And this is a direction for making the technology more robust and making our cars better drivers.
That they would know what the unknowns are. They're not unknowns anymore.
Start to learn about their own blind spots with a layer of reasoning about that in particular.
Right, they know their limitations. So at some point they would just signal their driver you take over.
As people out there who know me very well, they know that I drive one of these cars and I've pushed it to the limit in terms of its ability to do its own thing versus to scream at me and so on. So it's very interesting trying to drive one of these self-driving cars or semi-driving.
How many times have you had to take over from the car?
Oh, it's of course all the time, and you got to stay alert.
You're not giving me a lot of confidence here. Let's go to
today. That's today.
It's early.
And I should say back to that tweeter. It's definitely the case that when we look at the downside of these technologies, we lose track of the fact that 35,000 deaths per year with human driving, almost 250,000 deaths because of preventable errors in hospitals per year in the U.S. alone. AI in both those places would provide incredible boosts and save many, many lives. So there are some trades here. We have to always consider the upside as well, not just the focus on the downside.
Could AI help prevent gun deaths?
You know, there's an interesting department right now that just came together at USC, bringing the Center of Social Work together with the Computer Science Department. It's one example of other kinds of work going on that are looking at really hard societal challenges. And so that, without me giving you a flippant yes, of course, you can imagine that we can start thinking about how we could collect data to understand better the root causes of why guns are used and so on and address them with systems that are data-centric. And so AI might have a role there.
Mm. Let's go to the phones to Chicago, to the Windy City with Wallace. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, good afternoon. I was in electronics for a number of years in the old style when we first came out with integrated circuits. But I'm interested now, and I'm not up to date with the new technology, but why can't systems prevent hacking? Is it because airwaves are hacking into the system, or is it direct wire?
Yeah.
So in the car situation, it's airwaves. There are five different ways you can hack into a car through airwaves. The reason why it's easy, relatively, to speaking to break into systems is that getting really good security is a super hard problem. There are many, many dimensions that you have to get right if you want the system to be secure. It's like an analogy with a house, right? To make your house secure, it's not enough to like lock the front door. You have to lock the front door and the back door, and that's not enough. You have to lock all the windows. It's the same thing in a computer. You have to lock every entryway. You have to make sure that your users are well trained, that they don't, you know, give away the password to somebody who calls on the phone and is convincing that they're their IT department and they need to give them a password. You have to have the hardware be correct. There's just many, many things that you have to get right. And if you don't get them all right, then there's a vulnerability that a hacker can break into.
And I think there is no such thing as non-hackable systems eventually. I mean, I keep thinking that before 2001, we did not know that we have to be careful about planes, you know, driving into the buildings. You know, that's just not something that we took into account. In general, I guess, we are going to be exposing interesting kinds of security breaches. And so it's an ongoing thing, unless you want to just, you know, shut yourself off from the world, the systems off from the world, in which case, of course, they're not of particular use at all.
We have to also, I think it's important to think through, it's not just about mechanism, machinery, and designs. It's also about regulation, laws, and treaties. For example, we could have treaties about what kind of systems can be fielded in military settings. We could have treaties that tell, let's say, we should not have nation states attacking civilian populations and private infrastructure and democratic institutions with cyber attacks. In fact, just last week, I'm proud to say that Microsoft announced in a policy statement that we need to have a digital Geneva Convention. So it's not all, there's a lot of people, people in society in the loop here. It's not just about fixing the computing.
Except I think one issue there is essentially the technologies there. You know, we take in CS and AI being extremely open, and so it may not even be just big state actors.
Absolutely.
You know, a high school kid sitting in the garage can do lots of interesting damage. And so it is going to be a continuing arms race between good and bad users.
Speaking of that, an interesting tweet from Vasu, who writes, do we currently have any security standards for Internet of Things devices? And who is monitoring the revolution? I mean, we make standards about, you know, for all kinds of things and, you know, ANSI things, you know, when I'm talking about those kind of standards. Are there any standards? If you make an Internet of Thing device, it has to be at least some sort of hack-proof somehow.
Well, hack-proof is a concept that isn't well-defined, right?
Right.
You have to
it's
talk
not
about
defined
hacking.
Yet anywhere.
With respect to, you always have to talk about hacking with respect to a threat model, kind of what kind of things can you imagine an attacker to do. But no, there are very few standards about the security of kinds of things. I think the aviation industry takes it the most seriously, but that's an outgrowth of the fact that they take safety of their codes the most seriously and spend a lot of time doing manual code reviews. I think, you know, Senator Markey from Massachusetts proposed a 5-star security crash rating for your cars like the safety ones, but that didn't go anywhere in Congress. So there's been some efforts, but nothing that is.
There's work afoot to think through best practices and potentially one day standards. That recently was created a group called the AI Partnership in support of people in society. Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google DeepMind, IBM, and Microsoft got together and agreed upon a set of tenets, and in working together through a nonprofit organization, arrayed around best practices and security and privacy are part of that kind of deliberation.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones to Washington, to Jeff. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show. I wanted to know what people were thinking about Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. And I know it's 50-plus years old, but is anybody taking it into consideration when making these security systems?
Good question. Rao, you know, didn't one of the laws say you can't attack people and will not attack its own human?
Indeed. In fact, I think even several years back, people were talking about, you know, the first law of robotics, which is essentially, you know, the taking the Asimov's laws and, you know, including them in the design of the robot. The interesting question, of course, is these are very general laws, and it's not necessarily obvious to machines at some point of time whether or not actually, you know, they are not harming somebody, they're trying to help somebody. So there is this whole set of paradoxes people talk about the machine assuming that it knows more about what's good for you than you really know. And there's more recent work actually from I think out of Berkeley on what's called the off switch problem, where you should be able to shut off your AI system. This is, I guess, in a much more far fetched long term scenarios. The nice thing that I like about what it says really is what bosses do to actually control their employees. You know, always keep what is expected somewhat ambiguous, and if you keep that ambiguous, then you know the robot mm-hmm. can never be completely sure, mm-hmm. and so it allows itself to be shut off. But well, yes, indeed, the Asimov's laws sort of start becoming the foundation right now.
All right, I got so many questions, so little time. I'm trying to get as many in. Let's talk about something important. I think that's also important to our discussions, and that's our ability to hold free and fair elections online or by hacking voting machines.
You know, before you even go to voting machines, Ira, I mean, one of my top concerns is that AI systems will be used and already have been used to automatically and algorithmically persuade people in a stealthy way to change their beliefs and to not vote or to vote differently. And I think this is going to be a very, very important rising crisis for democracy and free thinking.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Can you give me an example of that?
Well, listen, there's lots of reports that even out of the last election of a company called Cambridge Analytica that was claiming to have worked very, very diligently at figuring out how to sequence messages to the right people based on their Facebook profiles, at least by report. There were reports back during the 2008 Obama campaign of companies that were doing interesting data mining to figure out how to ideally allocate resources and who to target and for changing votes in swing states.
All right, I got to change that because I have so much to talk about. I have to get up, and I want to talk about the voting machines. I want to get to the voting machines.
Sure.
What are your feelings about that?
Yeah, I think voting machines are susceptible to hacking. I think an interesting thing is that the sort of more you know about computers, the less comfortable you are with electronic voting. You know, historically, there have been coalitions of computer scientists who've gotten involved in the political process to really educate lawmakers about the dangers of mandating electronic voting. Basically, you know, people tend to trust computers to do the right thing, like lay people who are not into computer science. But in fact, computers do what they're told to do, and software is designed to be updated and replaced. So a voting machine is going to count according to the latest version of software that's on it. And that could be the correct version of the software that was installed by the election, the people running the election, but it could be that it was hacked by somebody or somebody sticks in a thumb drive and changes the code. And then it counts however the code that was just added. People have been doing a lot of research on how to build more secure voting systems that will come along with an audit trail that you can check retroactively.
Well, how do we supervise?
In a physical way?
How do you supervise this happening or not? How do you surveil this, make sure it doesn't happen?
Yeah, so the research is you want to provide a way for the person who voted to be able to confirm that the system recorded the vote the way that they expected in a physical kind of thing, so that there's a physical paper trail that can later go back and check to make sure that the mm-hmm. physical vote matched the electronic vote. It's very important that the voter doesn't get to show that physical proof to other people, because that opens up the possibility of buying votes. So it's a very delicate combination of computer science and algorithms and social processes and our understanding of votes. So it's not something to be done casually. It has, again, huge upsides. Right, it would allow our military people to vote when they're overseas. There's lots of upsides to it, but it has to be done very carefully, and I'm concerned that it's not being done carefully to date.
I have to stop this conversation. This is great. We'll have to continue this. I'm running out of time. I want to thank Kathleen Fisher, Eric Horvitz, and Subbarao Kambapati. Thank you both and thank you all, and have a great meeting at Arizona State University this weekend. One last thing before we go. Earlier this week, we got word of the death of Mildred Dresselhaus. She was a professor emerita at MIT. She was a physicist, a material scientist, and a nanotechnology pioneer called by some the Queen of Carbon. She was also a leader in advocating for women in the sciences. I spoke to her back in 2007.
When I first came to MIT in the 1960s, my activities were first focused on women in science within my own institution, because when I came, we only had 4% of women at MIT, period, and fewer even in physics. So that was really, really small numbers. And today, we're getting close to the 50% mark. And that's an amazing achievement in one's lifetime. Of course, I didn't have that much to do with making it all happen. When I became president of the American Physical Society, which is the premier physics society worldwide, at that point, I changed my emphasis and moved to thinking about women in physics for the whole country, because I was encouraged by my compatriots at the Physical Society. There were so few of us in physics at that time. And we had an impact. You know, one person can have an impact on things like that. It's amazing.
Mildred Dresselhaus, scientist, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the National Medal of Science, passed away this week at the age of 86. If you're listening from Orlando, you can catch us live. We're going to be in Orlando Tuesday, not Friday, Tuesday, March 28th at the Bob Carr Theater. It's going to be in the evening, so you can get down there. We'll be talking a lot about futuristic geeky topics and having live demonstrations. You can get your tickets now. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers, Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Luke Raskin is our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, Jack Harwitz, our engineers at the controls at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you want to write us, you can write us at Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can email us scifry@sciencefriday.com. Go to our website, leave us a mail, a message there, or on Facebook and Twitter. You know how to find us. We're here all week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.